Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking about the stories, the actual depth and where they come from and why it matters more now than probably in a long, long time. And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but we have to understand in the COVID scenario, it's more important that we look at how we're going to come out the other side of this and how we report on these things and some of the fact checks that happen, some of the amazing work that goes into it. We all, you know, it's easy. No one ever loses a fight, as I say, Martin, all the time. It's easy to always say, it's easy to go and say, the mainstream media, and you'll always win. You'll always get likes and retweets, but it just doesn't bear up facts. Actually, Martin, we're going live this evening, is it?
Don Foster live this evening, 8 o'clock. We'll have a good talk about Brexit, about breaking the law, but only specific little parts of the law. And we'll talk all things UK with Don. Looking forward to that one, Tony. That's 8 o'clock. So patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Come on in and have a listen.
Yeah, we always have good fun with Don. Anyway, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined by freelance journalist with noteworthy Peter Maguire and managing editor of the journal, Susan Daly. Guys, thanks so much for coming on to talk to us.
Hi, guys.
Listen, Susan, do you mind if we start with you? Because I've just given a bit of a preamble there, and I mentioned noteworthy at the outset. And the reason being is, obviously, Mark, we had to do our plug there for our Patreon. You know, we are listener funded. This is how we operate, and luckily we've listeners who do actually put their hands in their pocket for the price of a cup of coffee. What was the genesis and the idea around Noteworthy?
So it's interesting because I'm calling here from mainstream media people. But it's true. I mean, you know, the journal maybe 10 years ago wasn't mainstream media, but it would be considered to be now. And I suppose that we're kind of top of the online market with maybe RT.ie and the Indo Online as well, which is, you know, quite a big growth in 10 years. But in that time as well, if you're talking about people talk, how do we fund journalism, right? Isn't that the thing everyone's talking about? And for us, you know, we have those eyeballs. So in terms of funding our general news, we've been doing okay. But it is a pie of which news organisations only have a slice, and it is being more and more taken over by the advertising that people are taking on social media giants like your Facebooks, your Googles and so on. So, you know, we're still working away on that, but it does mean that our business model has been, up to this point, about 80 or 90% of it is coming, the revenue is coming from advertising. Hmm. Now, that is a precarious position to be in. It also means that there's a lot of things that you would find difficult to fund in journalism when your revenue is linked to advertising. So if we look at fact-checking, for example, you know, that's a unit that I set up 4 years ago on the journal, and that is never has advertising around it. We don't think it's appropriate, and we would find it difficult then to kind of be open to fact-checking everything if you're worried about who's going to pop up around it. But we have found that to be of such service to our audience, and it brings people in, that it makes sense to keep doing it, and we're going to keep doing that. The other side of investigative journalism, of course we can do it. We have people in there who can do things really well. The journal does produce great exclusives and originals. But if you're talking about those kind of things you think about that take a few months, which Peter here, one of the reporters, is going to talk about in a while, like, how do you fund that? You certainly can put advertising around it. Do you know why? Because advertisers don't want to be around contentious or grotty issues, or, you know, it makes sense, right? They're in the business of selling a brand, and what do you want to align your brand to? The other thing is that thing costs a lot of money. So that's a very long preamble into saying that we decided what is our woo 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 dot show us the money dot e for investigative journalism. And we, myself and the CEO, Adrian, we've been talking about this for a long time. And about, I would say now it's 3 years ago, we were looking at what is it people would want to pay for and fund. So we're not talking about a generic paywall, but are there stories out there that people can cover, either they're local, so they matter intensely to a certain bunch of people, but not nationally, right? Or they are a particular subject that, again, might touch a lot of people, but who has the resources to do that? So we decided to set up Noteworthy. We went looking for funding. So we do have, hilariously, a grant from Google, but it is their digital news initiative. So they're quite hands-off with that. Their thing is to try and help people build sustainable business models for journalism rather than pay for journalism directly, which I'm much more comfortable about the model thing rather than someone giving money saying, publish that. That's not a good model. Mm-hmm. So we decided to set up Noteworthy with a grant from that, which we matched with funding from Journal Media. So we have a lot of skin in the game here. With Noteworthy, the way it works is we don't decide necessarily what's going to be investigated. We ask the public to come to us with submissions. When you go to Noteworthy, one of the major things there is not, give us the money. It is that too. But it's give us the ideas. What are we missing? Yeah. What is mainstream media not covering? What is local media no longer resourced to do? So people send in submissions. Then the editorial team gets involved and we start looking at what they send in. We do some hours of research. And if we think there's a story in it, then we'll create a proposal around that and say, this is exactly what we want to investigate. We publish it on Noteworthy, and then we open a funding for that specific proposal, and you can put money in and it goes directly to that proposal. You see the money totting up, and when we reach our funding target, we start the work in earnest on it, and then we publish it. And because we have the journal as one of our publications and has a huge reach, we always publish it on the journal, we publish it on Noteworthy. And we also, because the journalism is already paid for once it gets funded, we also are open to people republishing it anywhere they want. They contact us. We want the credit on it for Noteworthy and so on, so that people can see where it was funded, how it was funded, so our contributors get the credit as well. But we want the journalism out there as much as possible. Like, we see it as public service journalism. Mm. So that's the big idea.
Yeah, and just, it reminds me, because before we started recording, we mentioned that we're not, none of us are of the age of the, born into the digital age. There used to be the one or two writers who were lucky enough to write for some of the best magazines that got those long form pieces, and they were allowed to go away for a month or 2 months and come back and deliver this epic piece that you got maybe every 12 weeks in the magazine that was close to your heart. So it's, we all miss that. And this kind of sounds, even talk about one of the tiers we use is, if you're chipping in at $6 a month, you can actually send us a thing, say, can you guys try and cover this? And we will look at it. We don't necessarily will, but we will certainly do our best to undertake to do that. Can I ask, though, how successful have you found it?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, look, this is the thing. It's a 2-year project, okay? So at the end of this, if it fails or doesn't fail, it continues exactly as it is, or we change it, we tweak it, and we use what we've learned either for the journal or to continue in some form or other. I think that's probably going to be more likely because we have learned a lot. Obviously, what we've learned is that, yes, investigative journalism is really expensive. So the amount of funding you have to get in for each piece, we have found that to be difficult, but we've still managed to fund 25 investigations and 100 articles in that time. So what we are also learning, though, is we can do lots of different things. It's opening other revenue avenues for us. So, for example, I've just gotten a grant from the EU for a cross-border investigation on migrant workers and horticulture. And we're now working with reporters in Bulgaria and Romania through the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network. So we've gotten that work funded. So we had a few contributions from the public in that. We were able to go back and say, guys, keep the rest of your money. We can get this done. We are also doing currently a collaboration with a national Sunday newspaper, which you won't see for a few weeks. But basically, we're spinning the work because they were investigating something similar. And we were like, we've got all these documents. They've got, we've got these ones. So we're putting them together. We're going to publish different things. But it means that we've kind of collaborated and both of our publications get these amazing stories out there. On the other side of it, like, I am actually surprised. There is some stuff that I was going, we have something here. There's an example I want to tell you about in Kilkenny. There was this bridge that was built across the city, right? And it was very contentious. And it turned out that a lot of people wanted to see a really comprehensive account of how the hell this happened, how the budget overran as much, why they didn't deliver the jobs they did, why it is butt ugly in the middle of a medieval city. And let's give Kilkenny its proper designation, city, okay? they wanted to know about this. And what we found was we started seeing these bursts of funding coming in, and we'd contact people and go, did you mean to give us this much? And they were like, oh no, it's just I was down the street, I was talking to Margaret, she was talking to Sean, and we're all in it. So I took all the money from them because they don't have PayPal. So I put it through my account. So there's that crossover, right, between the real world and the digital world that we're talking about, that we as non-digital natives are worried about. And so we found that actually appealing to people and saying, you can pay for just this piece of journalism that really matters to you and impacts on your life, was really important to them. And that Kilkenny thing got funded like that. I'm clicking my finger here, you can't see it. And it published in two parts. It had Kilkenny Radio hopping off the dial for about a week. And it surfaced everything there again. And you know what? It didn't change anything. The bridge is there. But what it did is say, this is how a local authority worked. And it wasn't even a big, you know, smoking gun. It wasn't corruption. Hmm. It was just a lot of inefficiencies and something that is being replicated around the country. And I loved that. And I thought, that's so important. And can we do more of this?
Just before you come in, Martin, we will fact check if Kilkenny's actually a city when this is over. So.
It's an official designation. Just take it for me, okay?
Susan, is the model transferable across broader media? Could it be a substitute for advertising, particularly in a COVID world where advertisers are far more selective where they're putting their money?
Yeah, and a good question, because Martin, like, we lost a rake of money in COVID journal media. This was, well, you know, I spoke about it openly. We had to shut our business site, Fora, with the loss of four jobs there. And we had to, we were all on pay cuts from the top down, I can tell you. And it was proportionate to what people were earning. People were on part time swan. Now, luckily, we're looking like we're able to reverse that in for Q4 for people within. And people were fantastic in the organisation. Everyone understood. But the point was that we weren't getting advertising. We dropped 60% in Q2, right? So we do have to look at what we can apply here. I don't think the model exactly as it is. You know, it's not a panacea, right? This isn't a silver bullet, because the amount of work that we have to do to actually promote the proposals to the right audience to say, this is something you might be interested in funding, actually takes up a lot of my time even, takes a lot of time of the team that are there. So there's a reporting, but then there's also all this background work. I'm not sure that's replicable for every single story. What I will say is that it does teach you that if you can hit on what we're missing in the gaps that people go, this was really important to me, but I didn't have a say over my local paper shutting down or the local radio station taking a revenue cut so they do more music and less news or something like that. That's where we kind of have a chance, right? And say, like, there are people invested enough in this. If, you know, if I was starting a business in the morning, I'd be looking at micro-local stuff. Yeah. I'd be looking at specific sectors where people are incredibly engaged because it's their whole life. We just published an investigation on why we don't all have solar panels on our roofs yet.
Sargent, was it?
Niall Sargent, yes, I know. He's known to this parish, is he?
I kind of have a crush, but we won't.
Oh, the most handsome environmentalist around.
He really is.
Well, do you know what? The poor old Niall, since he joined us, has pretty much been working not in the office, so he's not really had the experience of being joshed about his fulsome hair or, you know, his dashing good looks or whatever. But yeah, no, Niall is an extremely impressive guy. Yeah. He worked for Interpol for a while in data and so on, so he's bringing a lot to the table to us. So the solar thing, for example, like, I couldn't believe how exercised people were about that. And, you know, I would be somebody who's interested in climate change impact and all that kind of thing, but I just couldn't get over it. So, you know, I wonder if there's sections that we'll start breaking out on general news. It's so covered now. It's really, we're going to have to figure out a different way on protecting the impartiality of that. I think that's going to be really important. What that is, I don't know yet, but I don't think the government are approaching it enough yet. They're throwing a few quid at local radio and, you know, faffing about around broadcasting fee, but they're not really addressing that situation we have with media where people are getting it from social media, not from reliable sources, who are now finding it hard to stay reliable because they don't have resources.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary, which actually brings us to Peter, finally, to talk about the fact that you have been doing long form stuff, Peter, and some of the work we're going to talk about today. Martin, you described it to me as harrowing.
Yeah, I just I am, Peter. It's disturbing. It gets in to your head. It gets into your soul. I just find it. I mean, it's great work. It is. Don't get me wrong. It's great work, but it is that very hard hitting stuff that Susan was talking about that you won't get an advertiser to put their money to. But it's also vital that with these stories come out. Absolutely vital. How do you get your head around it?
Yeah, I got funded actually like Niall as well. We both got funded years ago from the Mary Raftery Journalism Fund. And the initial project I got funded for with them was sex education, which actually bled into kind of a lot of Michelle Hennessy's work in the journal. And to some extent, it's kind of how I kind of got to know the journal quite well. And then we got funded again through Mary Raftery to look at this topic of child sex abuse. And that was kind of a topic I found myself writing a lot more about. And obviously for the past year, I've been working with Susan and the team in the journal, in Noteworthy at the journal, and written a number of long form pieces. And I guess the idea for this story really came from that kind of background work. I was contacted by three sisters, June, Joyce and Paula Kavanagh, and they had been sexually abused throughout their childhood by their father. He was later jailed for the crimes against his children and for other children in that neighbourhood. And they asked me to look into a story involving a woman who we're going to refer to in the upcoming articles on Noteworthy as Abigail. And on the face of it, Abigail's story did sound a little bit incredible, to be quite honest. But because of kind of the relationship I would have with the Kavanagh sisters and the trust I'd have in them over the years and working with them on these topics, I decided to go to meet her. And Abigail herself, she was abused as a child three times. And it certainly seems that somebody who experiences sexual abuse once might be more vulnerable to being victimized again. And as she saw it, at least, her experience was that she'd complain about the crimes committed against her to the guards, or she'd go to her family about them, and she'd find herself in a psychiatric institution without getting any real therapeutic support. So it kind of got us thinking, and, you know, talking to Susan about it as well. And Susan has been phenomenally supportive of this project and really helped to get it over the line and to get the funding for it. We wanted to look into then what is the actual experiences of sexual abuse survivors when they come forward, because we all hear, you know, oh, you should come forward and, you know, trust the justice system, and here's what you should do. And so, you know, if somebody does everything they're supposed to do and they do it right, how does it turn out? In Abigail's case, as we'll show in the pieces that will be published very soon on Noteworthy, Gardaí did investigate her case. They did send a file to DPP. The DPP decided not to prosecute because, you know, they did review the evidence, and the DPP's obligation is to ensure that they have sufficient evidence that would convince a jury beyond reasonable doubt. They didn't feel that they'd reach the bar in this case. So what we started doing then is we put the funding, we put the proposal up on the Noteworthy website, and there's lots of other proposals up there at the moment. I know that Maria Delaney and Niall Sargent, the full-time staff in Noteworthy, and Susan as well, are working on getting a lot of other good stories over the line. And eventually it took a while, it took about a year. And again, you know, there was a lot of support from Susan, and myself and Susan looked at ways in which we could get the funding we needed for this. And we wanted to show what kind of supports are in place for people who do want to bring their abusers to justice, and what kind of therapeutic help is available. So we spoke to quite a large number of people, actually, and much more than I've ever spoken to for any other long form piece or any other.
It's fantastic work, and everybody's going to have to check it out. The first article goes live tomorrow, is it?
That's it, yeah, tomorrow, Saturday, the 12th of September, and the second one is then on Sunday, the following day. And thanks, Tony and Martin as well for having us on.
Not at all. You mentioned though the where this is going. So just to give listeners an idea, a lot of this, as we see it, because you've spoken to people who've been on, you know, on guests and actually host of a Tortoise Shack podcast in Linda, Linda Hayden, and you know, you've spoken to so many more people. But part of it now, and I suppose what we're concerned about is the after, not just the actual abuse, but the actual trauma afterwards. Some of your findings on that are very stark.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that shows that survivors of childhood sexual abuse can suffer severe lifelong trauma then as adults, not to mention the trauma that, you know, people who experience sexual violence as adults experience. And some of the people we spoke to of the 40, and just to say, we were able to speak to 40 because of lockdown, actually, because normally for something like this, I'd go and meet people. I'd sit there, I'd have the dictaphone on, and then I'd have to transcribe afterwards. The time we saved on travel and transcription meant that I was able to talk to a lot more people to get something a lot more comprehensive. But anyway, yeah, so a lot of people felt that, you know, besides getting inadequate support in the justice system, that afterwards they felt their response to their trauma had been to place them in mental health facilities, sometimes involuntarily, and this is in accordance with the 2001 Mental Health Act. And we spoke to a whistleblower within the HSE. Obviously, I won't reveal that person's identity or gender. And they kind of explained to us how the mental health system, particularly for inpatients, isn't really set up to support the survivors of sexual abuse. And that's not through corruption or anything like that. It's just perhaps, you know, our evolving understanding of this, and it's perhaps not up to where it needs to be, because a lot of survivors of sexual trauma, sexual violence, will suffer from something that's only recently recognized by the World Health Organization, and that's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And the system just isn't really set up to work with them. So we know that some people, it is as stark as Ireland is continuing to institutionalize some victims of sexual crimes, which is something we did in the past with Magdalen Laundries. You know, if women are raped, they found themselves in the laundry. And I think there is certainly some evidence that we'll show in our piece to suggest that this might still be happening today. And certainly amongst the advocacy groups we spoke to as well, there is acknowledgement that the mental health services are far behind, and it's not far from adequate that we would institutionalize victims of sexual crimes.
For me, it was quite stark, the percentage of people who've ended up in mental institutes. It's, I suppose, when you look at it, Vincent Brown said years ago that we have this huge problem in Ireland with sexual abuse. We have this massive, massive problem with sexual abuse. And we know that in homelessness services, and I hate the phrase rough sleepers, but it exists, but people who are sleeping rough, that a lot of them have come from sexual abuse, unresolved sexual abuse, and also in mental health. So are we really looking at a situation where we may not have a huge homelessness problem and a huge mental health problem, but we do actually have a huge sexual abuse problem, which is precipitating these other problems?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at the prison population as well, you'll see the same. You'll see the same problem, because of, particularly when it, and the clinical psychologist who spoke to us from the HSE really outlines this very well as to how actually that works psychologically for people, and how, as a child, suffering something so terrifying and traumatic can lead to all sorts of problems with behavior. There seems to be some evidence of a connection between borderline personality disorder and sexual violence in some cases, not in all cases, obviously. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder, and all these things lead to people, what you might call, acting out, you know, and committing crimes or just being unwell in themselves. And, you know, the fact that we don't seem to have the therapeutic supports in place for them is very problematic. And that's really something we get into in the second part of the feature. That the first part really is looking at the criminal justice system and its response.
Peter, look, we're probably going to wrap this now, because I think what we're going to come back to this, and thank you so much for your time, and thank you to Susan for her time. We're going to come back to this in over the coming days on across our platform as well. We're going to return to it. We're going to try and talk to some of the people involved, and we will try and raise that. But I would say to people, the articles are out over this weekend. Read them, inform yourself, make sure you and actually if you get something out of it, give something back, put your hands in your pockets, guys. We know that we're always doing it, and we always ask for it, and we do need it. That's why we're asking for it, because work like this matters. And I think when you sit down and you read these pieces, you will understand the real change and the trauma that we need to address as a society, and by just exposing it as much as you have in those articles, and as we hope to actually add to over the coming days, I think people say, well, that's worth putting your hands in your pocket. It's worth the price of a pint, as we continually say.
Peter, thank you so much, and the same to yourselves, guys. I hope people support you, both of you as well, and the work that you're doing.
Just one last thing from me, Peter. I hope that doing something like that is stressful on you and traumatizing on you as well, and I hope that you're taking the time to take care of your own mental health after dealing with such difficult subjects.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
Listen, folks, thanks for listening. We will be back to this. There's no question we will be back to this. Keep an eye on your feeds, and actually make sure we will then update this podcast with the link to the first article, and you'll be able to follow up with the second one. Thanks for listening. Talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.